Hello, Tracy here. And one topic that has been coming up for a lot of people, and always does come up for a lot of people, is the concept of shame. I've actually discussed it here and there in this podcast and also in the other podcast, Just Deep Enough with Josh and Tracy, a little bit. We've here and there kind of discussed the concept of shame. And so I've touched on the concept that shame is not the same as a conscience. So I'm going to kind of review that a little bit, that concept. So people sometimes sort of associate shame with virtue or being a good moral person. And they think, well, without shame, I would just be a horrible person. Shame is what's keeping me upright in society. So I like to differentiate. Shame is not the same as a conscience in that people will often feel shame for things that they didn't do wrong. The clearest example of that I like to point to is how victims of, for instance, child abuse will often feel shame for having those experiences. They'll feel shame that they were the victim of child abuse. Well, I don't think there's any group that we can all more collectively agree are not responsible. That's not, we are not, a child is not responsible for abuse that they experience. So then why do they feel shame? If it was a conscience, a person would only feel bad if something was really their fault, or they would only have the sense of, oh, I'm wrong, if it was something that they had actually done that was wrong. So my definition of a conscience is when we do what we believe is right because, to the best of our knowledge, it is right, and we avoid doing what is wrong because, to the best of our knowledge, it is wrong. And we do that out of a sense of basically care for ourselves and our community. We're not doing what's right and avoiding what's wrong just because, we don't want to go to jail or something like that. Because, like, if a person is being, quote, good just because they don't want to go to jail or they don't want some sort of a punishment, I wouldn't call that a conscience. I'd call that more just like a fear of punishment, which I also don't think is a conscience. A conscience is when you, to put it really simply, is when you would, like, perhaps stop at a stop sign because you don't want to cause an accident or you don't want to run anybody over. Rather than stopping at a stop sign just because you don't want to get a ticket. Like, if I'm gonna, like, the only reason I ever stop at stop signs is because I don't want to get a ticket. Well, then I think you're forgetting the bigger picture of why we have things like stop signs. So that's the idea of a conscience. And then shame is this other thing. It's this yucky feeling that people have. And in my work over the last couple of decades of working with a lot of people on their issues, what I really discovered is that absolutely everybody at some point hits this spot in themselves that is shame. And it's a very painful feeling. It feels very scary to feel it. And so people try not to feel it in one way or another. It's that feeling of shame that people have in them that is not associated with anything they've actually done. It's almost like an appendix or something, Like, we have certain organs in our bodies that nobody knows what they're really for. They can cause us trouble. Like, I did have to have my appendix removed one time, even though nobody's entirely sure what an appendix does, if it does anything at all. But sometimes it can flare up and you have to have it removed, or it could kill you. Well, that's kind of like shame. We all have this shame installed in us, but it doesn't serve the purpose we think it will. It doesn't make us better people. It's that belief that we have, that people have, that if you could see who I really am, you would not like it. You would think it was yucky. And so people carry this sense of, I'm not good enough. There's something wrong with me. I'm broken. Heck, sometimes when people talk about the concept of original sin, that you see in the idea that there's original sin, that a child is born with original sin and they have to, have it removed, and people associate it with the mythology of Adam and Eve and all of that. Well, that's always kind of stuck in my craw. I might do another episode sometime about some of the interpretations of that idea that I find particularly unhelpful, but we'll skip that for now. But it's a sense of there's something in me that's broken. Now, that doesn't have to be true for it to feel true. So one of the ways that people deal with that little, what I call the shame glob that resides in everybody's belly until they do the work to resolve it and heal it, that we have this feeling of I'm not good enough and I can't. I have to do all kinds of things to avoid feeling that feeling, whether it's to ignore it, pretend it's not there, try to be perfect, because the only way to counter this awful badness that I have deep down is to be perfect. And of course, since perfection is not a possibility in the dimension of time and space that we live in, then a person who is carrying that sense of shame and thinks they have to be perfect will never be able to feel okay. If you're telling yourself, I have to be perfect in order to be okay, then you're basically never going to feel okay because you're never going to actually be able to achieve perfection. And it's not because you're not trying hard enough, it's because perfection doesn't exist in time and space. And because in time and space, everything is constantly changing and moving. The finish line is never in the same place twice. So, perfection would require that everything, that you get to this exact moment in time when everything's perfect, and then that, bam, nothing changes. Well, that's not one of the things we have here. Perfection may exist in some other level of consciousness or, in some heavenly dimension, but it doesn't exist here. So, like I said, one of the ways that people try to fight against their feeling of shame is by trying to be perfect. That does not work. Another way that people sometimes try to fight against their feeling of shame or get away from their feeling of shame is by blaming other people. So rather than letting themselves feel their own shame, they focus on how that person should be ashamed. That person should be ashamed. That person should be ashamed. They have the shame. And while that doesn't fundamentally heal the shame feeling that that individual feels in themselves, it does, in a sense, sort of distract them or make them, on some unconscious level, feel like, well, at least I'm not as bad as that guy. You'll see that with people who are big into blaming as their defense mechanism, that they get really, really interested in noticing if someone else is not as good as they are. Like, oh, look at that person. Well, at least I'm not like that. So, in a way, they're setting up this dynamic where, in order to avoid the feeling the pain of their own shame, they decide that someone else is way worse than they are. So that's a good starting point. I'm going to proceed more on this idea of shame in a little bit, but right now, gonna take a break. Hi. All right, so back from the break, and let's talk a bit about where this shame comes from. Now, frankly, there's probably a lot of theories about where the shame comes from, so I'm going to tell you my theory on that. When we are infants, we are born into a situation in which, understandably, we need to figure out how to make people pay attention to us so that we can get fed and sleep indoors and have, our basic needs met. And so we have instinctive abilities to make that little noise that babies make that make people want them to not make that noise anymore, and a healthy, not messed up person who is a parent will interact with that baby in such a way that helps the baby by making the baby not hungry and help the baby be clean and help the baby feel comforted and safe and connected
And that will help the baby to, get their needs met. So the baby figures out at a certain point that if I make certain noises, if I make eye contact, if I act super cute, if I do something, I can get this caregiver to provide me with the care that I need to survive. So that does work for the most part, except in extreme situations. That does work for the baby. And so the baby, aka you, when you were a baby, began to figure out that you could influence your environment. You could make adults provide you with care if you behaved in certain ways. So it's natural at that point to assume that, I must be, because I am doing it right, I am making the doing the right behaviors, I am getting what I need. Therefore, I, through my behavior of being a good little baby slash toddler slash child slash teenager slash adult, can get other people to do what I need them to do if I behave a certain way. So naturally, we believe that we have control and that our behavior is making people behave well. And the natural extension of that idea is that if I don't do a good job, if I'm not doing it right, if I am bad in some way, I won't get my basic needs met. Now, if everything was working perfectly, perhaps there would be a decent rationale for that kind of thinking. However, when a child is born into this world, they don't always get excellent care, and frankly, they'll never get perfect care. As I mentioned in the first part of this episode, there are no perfect people. That means, of course, there are also no perfect parents. There are no perfect relationships. There are no perfect interactions. But if I believe that my behavior is what makes people act right, and my behavior also can make people be crummy, then I will feel that I am responsible. It in that way becomes easier for me to believe that if I'm not getting the care and connection that I need, that it's because I am bad. Of course, that is a false conclusion to come to in that situation, because basically, if you have a care provider that, for whatever reasons of their own, is not able or willing to provide what you need, that's really on them. That's due to something going on in them, likely a result of their own poor childhood experiences or their own issues that inhibit them from providing you the care, or they feel resentful toward providing that care. Or let's say that they're just a very depressed person, a person who's depressed or anxious or whatever is going on. When they ideally would be providing care for you, they are held back from doing that because of their own issues. So rather than thinking as a little tiny child, oh, gee, my parent has issues, which would be a far too sophisticated thought for any of us to have at that age, we assume, oh, well, when I'm quote unquote good, I get care that I need. Then when I'm not getting care that I need, I must be being quote unquote bad. In other words, I am bad, and I am therefore responsible for other people hurting me. Now you'd think, well, but yeah, but that isn't true. And of course, it isn't true. Especially when we're talking about a little tiny child, they are just being what they are. They're not choosing to be either good or bad. They're just basically trying to survive. As we get older, and if that issue doesn't get healed, or up until it does, if it does get healed, we continue to believe this idea that I am responsible for other people's behavior. And the reason why that idea is particularly difficult to let go of, one of the main reasons, one of the core reasons why that idea can be very difficult to let go of, is because for a lot of people, it feels less frightening to think that they are responsible for other people's behavior, that other people that other people's behavior is, quote, their fault. Like, it's my fault if you are angry or upset. That feels less scary than to really let in the idea that I don't have control over your behavior. If I think, oh, everything is my fault, then I feel like I, even though I'm doing it badly, it is still within my power to change it. Whereas if I realize that at the end of the day, I can sometimes influence another person if they want to be influenced, I am never really actually in control of what they do. So that feels scarier. I'm not in control feels a lot scarier to a lot of people, to maybe all of us at some point, than to think that I'm responsible for everything. Everything's my fault. Another thing is if you're interacting with a person who, through experience you've seen, is not going to make changes in themselves to be less hurtful, it feels like a relief if you can find a way in which the whole thing is actually your fault. If it's my fault, well, then at least I know I can fix it. If it's your fault, I'm screwed, because I don't think you are going to fix it. So if someone is being mean or cruel to you and you feel like, well, you know, if I just try harder, then they will be nice. Then you feel like, well, at least I can change it. You know, I have some possibility of getting out of the situation through my own behavior, which I can potentially control. Whereas if I'm dependent on that other person to want to change, then I can't control the situation. Now, the truth of the situation is that the other person really is the one who is responsible and in control of their behavior. And while if they wish to be influenced or are willing to be influenced by you, they can and will be. But if they don't want to, nothing you do is going to make them be a different person. There's literally nothing that you cannot be a good enough person to make another person decide to be good. And your mistakes aren't what make them be unkind. They may, in fact, want to blame you, because if you get yourself in a situation with someone whose defense mechanism is blaming other people and saying, you should be ashamed. And then you're over here saying, yeah, it's my fault. So that means I can change it. It is basically a recipe for the narcissistic abuse cycle that many of you sometimes experience, where you think, well, I'll just be perfect. And then they will want to also be better. And if they're not wanting to be better and be kinder to me, then it's because I just didn't try hard enough. So I'll try harder and harder and harder and harder and harder. They try less and less and less. And that's how that goes down. So that's one of the ways in which shame is a driving engine that perpetuates unhealthy interactions and doesn't improve situations at all. So anyway, so that's a little bit about shame. I felt like it was worth kind of revisiting and drilling in on that a little bit more. I will call that a day on that one. And thanks for listening. And I'll talk to you next time. Okay, bye.